Vale, de forno.
Again, I'll just remind counsel, if you haven't already done so, please sign in before you leave the courtroom. All right, this is the matter of Joshua Rodriguez Wood against Commonwealth, Mr. Broccoletti and Ms. Ford. Mr. Broccoletti, good morning. How are you today?
Good morning, Your Honor.
Would you like to reserve any of your time for rebuttal?
5 minutes, please.
You may proceed when you're ready.
May it please the court, my name is James Broccoletti, and I'm representing Joshua Wood before this court today. I think we start with a couple of basic principles that are applicable to this particular case. First of all, that the Commonwealth's evidence must be consistent only with the guilt of the accused, and that the Commonwealth must prove beyond a reasonable doubt the guilt of the defendant, which is derived from a single source, which is not in equipoise on the essential elements of the crime. In this particular case, what we're not talking about is the sufficiency of the evidence case. That's not what we're talking about. What we're also not talking about is the inherent credibility of the witness, Ms. Ricola Lachey. Those are not issues that I'm addressing before
the
court.
No, you managed to confuse me, Mr. Broccoletti, okay. Because I thought your assignment of error was that the inconsistencies between the eyewitnesses could not be reconciled as a matter of law. And if that isn't a sufficiency argument, then what is it?
It's a matter of, as Moore v. Commonwealth said, the equipoise of the Commonwealth evidence presents itself. Inconsistencies, I agree, can be resolved by the jury when is the light red or is the light green? Was the defendant left-handed or right-handed? Are there inconsistencies in the description of the witnesses?
So those, Mr. Broccoletti, isn't Moore inapplicable here? Because Moore deals with a single witness who testifies to two different things about vaginal penetration, that one it was penetration and one it wasn't. And didn't the court in Moore say that when it is other evidence that might be in controversy, that that's the realm of the fact finder? And if that's the case, assuming that there are inconsistencies, why isn't that something they believe to be resolved by the fact finder?
Because in this particular case, those other witnesses that the court just referred to are Commonwealth witnesses, evidence that the Commonwealth vouched for, evidence that the Commonwealth presented, witnesses that the Commonwealth called. And the reason they got boxed into that position is because they filed a motion for joinder.
But that's not what Moore says. Moore specifically indicates that, obviously, if it's coming from a single source, that the inconsistencies in the Commonwealth's case in chief, may bind it. But if you're having it from other sources, it's a different posture.
Well,
and therefore, it's up to the determination of the fact finder. So I guess what I'm asking is, how is that not applicable?
Because Moore also says, as I started, that the Commonwealth's evidence must be consistent only with the guilt of the accused. And the Commonwealth's evidence in this case was not consistent only with the guilt of the accused. When you consider Mr. Coville, Sir Thomas Boyd, and the special agent from the FBI. All of those three witnesses, I'd suggest to the court, were inconsistent with the guilt of the accused. And when the Commonwealth vouches for them and calls them, then they're supporting that as evidence. Well, and the single source that the court talked about, just one second, the single source that the court talked about with respect to Moore was because that was the only witness to testify as to the penetration.
Well, if I understand your argument, Mr. Broccoletti, I'll give you this hypothetical and you tell me how that reconciles with your argument. If you have a case, let's say a reckless driving case, and the Commonwealth presents two witnesses. Witness A says the light was red, but the defendant was traveling at about 35 miles an hour. Witness B says the light was green, but the defendant was traveling at 60 miles an hour, and it's a 45 mile an hour speed limit. Now, the Commonwealth presented two witnesses that are internally inconsistent. But cannot the fact finder pick and choose between the witnesses and believe some of what one witness says, disbelieve part of it, believe what some of the other witnesses says, disbelieve part of it, and conclude that the evidence is sufficient for a reckless driving conviction?
In your hypothetical, depending upon which witness you believe, the defendant is still guilty of the reckless driving charge.
The fact finder doesn't have to believe one witness in their entirety versus the other witness in their entirety, do
but
they?
Both of those witnesses establish guilt. In this particular case, three of the witnesses exclude guilt, and that's what the difference in your hypothetical would be.
How is it not? Let's start from this supposition. Is it arguable that it's actually not inconsistency between the witnesses, but rather a matter of perspective? If you take it from the point of Mr. Coville, he indicates that he's ahead of Lachey and the victim. And doesn't actually, he hears a commotion behind him when two individuals come up and rob him. He runs off into the woods when the shots are fired. Mr. Boyd, also, I think he's seeing it from another perspective. So the question is, how would you actually characterize it? Is it fair to characterize it as simply a matter of perspective rather than inconsistency? And if we're starting from that premise, where does that put your argument?
With respect to Mr. Coville, when the court examines what Mr. Coville says, he's walking down the sidewalk. The court's absolutely correct about that. Ms. Lawson is behind, Ms. Lachey is behind him, as well as the decedent. He notices two men that are behind him, and he has a sixth sense about them, I think that the evidence was. And on page 458 of the appendix, he said that the defendant was not one of those two men. That's number one. Number two, he sees two men that are in front of him in a different area standing on the corner up ahead. Those two men eventually approach. One of those men he identifies as Roy Turner. No question about it, Mr. Turner was involved. But then also on page 466 of the appendix, he says that the second guy that was with Mr. Turner was light-skinned. And I said, is Mr. Wood light-skinned? No, he's dark-skinned.
So what do we do with the fact that he runs off into the woods when the shots are fired? We also have indication that there are three different guns.
Correct.
And Ms. Lachey testifies twice in an identification by, you know, a lineup, as well as in court, that the appellant was one of the shooters, or at least the shooter that she saw shoot the decedent.
Correct.
How do we?
Because she also says there was only one shooter, and we know that's not true.
I want to get back to what Judge Humphreys began with, in a sense. It sounds as though your argument is that if the Commonwealth presented the witnesses, they're Commonwealth witnesses, as you say, that the trier of fact has to accept them in full cloth, everything. No weight is accorded it. One doesn't get to choose aspects of each of those witnesses' testimony and put together all of that to come out with a conclusion. Is that what you're arguing?
No, it's not.
Well, isn't that what happened here? Just because there's inconsistency, it seems to me, there are other elements that a trier of fact gets to apply to determine which parts of the Commonwealth's evidence will hold. And some of it is just weight.
I understand, and I think that's true, and I would agree with you in a normal sense where you have an issue of, again, what color clothes did the defendant have on, or the car, or things of that particular nature.
So why
those
is this
are factual,
different?
But here you have definitive, positive evidence that the defendant was not one of the shooters introduced by evidence from the Commonwealth. That's not inconsistent.
Mr. Broccoletti, is that a fair characterization, or is that just an observation that those witnesses say or saw, rather than saying definitively he is not one of the shooters? They're saying that he's not one of the shooters they saw.
Well, then how can you say that Ms. Lachey is credible in saying that she saw the shooters? It's the same analysis.
The distinctions, you're letting out all the distinctions that a trier of fact is allowed to make.
I disagree with you with that because I'm not.
I'm clearly on the wrong track.
No, ma'am. I understand that completely, and it's a difficult, it's an unusual concept to address to the court. I think the distinctions that we're trying to draw are that with respect to the inconsistencies that Your Honor is talking about, clearly the fact finder, the laws can accept, reject, accept and hold. That's a jury instruction that we give to them. That's not the issue that's before the court, because the issue before the court is definitive, positive evidence introduced by the Commonwealth's witnesses that the defendant wasn't there. He was not one of the shooters. So under those circumstances, under Moore, when we talk about that the Commonwealth's evidence, and again...
So let me make sure I understand what you just said, because I'm confused again. So...
I'm sorry, I don't mean to confuse you.
That's all right. It's so easy in my case. And you've done it masterfully for years. So. But do I understand your argument to be that if the Commonwealth puts on evidence where one witness says or testifies to information that is entirely incriminating, but other witnesses testify to information that, while maybe relevant, are not incriminating, that the Commonwealth is prohibited from convicting under those circumstances because they presented evidence at least on its face, would seem to conflict with other evidence they've offered?
No, but I think that this case takes that hypothetical to the extreme, and again, I don't mean to sound like a broken record, because in this particular...
You're failing at that.
Sir?
You're failing at that, but go ahead.
We provoked.
Well, you deal the hand that you dealt, right? You play the hand that you dealt.
I hear you.
But in this particular case, where you have definitive evidence from the witnesses, Mr. Coville, Mr. Boyd, and the special agent from the FBI, that the defendant was not the shooter. Under those circumstances, it's not just lack of incriminating evidence, it's positive exculpatory evidence introduced through
counsel,
the Commonwealth's case.
Let's try it from this perspective. Both Mr. Boyd and Mr. Koval talk about two people that they saw.
Mr. Koval talks about four people.
Well, four individuals. But Mr. Koval, in terms of, I'm talking about the shooters, maybe
correct.
More specific.
Right.
He indicates that he sees two shooters. But we know that there are three different types of bullets that are retrieved from the decedent.
Correct.
Okay. Well, isn't that a fact that the trier fact could consider in terms of, again, getting back to whether we're not really dealing with inconsistencies, but simply different perspectives of the witnesses? And if we're in that posture, where does that put your argument?
Well, two factors with respect to that. Number one, it's certainly not unusual for a person under these circumstances to have two types of weapons. There's two .40 calibers that are another different caliber. One person could have two guns. But also, Mr. Koval puts four people there. And if the court concludes that there were three people that were shooting, out of those four people, none of them, Mr. Koval says, were the defendant. So we get back to point A, which I'm trying to make to the court, and I see my time is up. Point A that I'm trying to make to the court with respect to the positive evidence that the Commonwealth introduces. One last thing before I sit down. For example, and Judge Annunziata, you were on this case a long, long time ago.
More.
It's called Fallfelder.
There's more.
I'm sorry.
I thought it was more.
No.
Fallfelder,
it's a case involving a habitual offender with a DMV uh-huh. transcript. And in the DMV transcript, the transcript points out in two particular circumstances. Number one, that the defendant was notified that he was a habitual offender. The second one, it had some language to the effect that he was eligible to be restored, which indicated that he was not. And the court held that the Commonwealth's evidence was in equipoise because in the same evidence that the Commonwealth introduced to establish the defendant's guilt, there were two completely different interpretations, one susceptible of guilt, one susceptible of not guilt.
But those were more definitive facts, were they not?
They were, I agree.
There's no room for...
Well, but the point is, and I'm trying to make to the court, is the Commonwealth's evidence can be in equipoise in that circumstance as well as in this.
But the important factor is evidence in equipoise, if we're
yes.
going to go back to that earlier case.
Yes, ma'am.
Evidence in equipoise.
Yes, ma'am.
My questions, I can't speak for my colleagues, have to do with can you make that conclusion in this case that the evidence was in equipoise? Because of the other factors that a trier factor can apply.
And that is the question.
Okay, got it.
You're into your rebuttal time. You don't need to deal with it now. I would like you to address the other assignment of error.
The text.
Yes, sir. Ms. Bourne?
Sorry.
May it please the court, Rosemary Bourne on behalf of the appellate. There's a difference between credibility of witnesses and evidence in equipoise. And in the case Moore that he cites, we have one witness saying two things that are completely incompatible on one element. Here, we have an issue of the credibility of the witnesses, and that must be accepted if the trier of fact, by this court, the trier of fact concludes that they are credible, unless that testimony is inherently incredible, and conflicts between those witnesses are to be resolved by the fact finder.
Well, Ms. Porter, the concept of when evidence is in equipoise is simply a situation where the fact finder who determines whether the burden of proof has been met, and in a criminal case it's beyond a reasonable doubt, evidence being in equipoise, which means it's evenly weighted, essentially, isn't enough. In other words, you know, the jury would effectively be instructed if they ever had a question that, you know, if we can't assign weight one way or the other, if we can't determine that the evidence is enough to get to beyond a reasonable doubt, you know, it would seem to me the appropriate instruction would be, well, that's not enough, and if that's the best you got, then you got to acquit. That's what equipoise, it seems to me, means. Now, that's a determination made at the trial level, not on appeal. We don't determine if evidence is in equipoise unless we're sitting in that box over there doing our civic duty as jurors.
Right, and Your Honor, I would also note that this Moore case, on the one side, but we also have reams of other cases which talk about evidence that where there was testimony that was in conflict with another witness, including one where one medical examiner said the cause of death was natural causes. Same element. Another medical examiner says, no, it's not natural causes. That seems to me
to be awfully similar to what, I mean, I would not certainly concede here that the evidence actually was in conflict, but even assuming for the sake of argument.
Well, that's not evidence. That, I mean, that hypothetical you just gave, it's not a hypothetical, it's from an actual case, but that's not evidence in equipoise, that's just conflicting evidence that needs to be resolved.
And that's what we have here. We have, if it is even conflicting, and I would argue that it's not.
But in the example you just gave, I can make sure I'm clear. Were they Commonwealth witnesses?
I believe that they both were Commonwealth witnesses.
Yeah, I mean, that's, if you're going to go apply law in this case, which is what we're supposed to do, it's important to have some cases that have the same basic factors that we're dealing with. And if they're both Commonwealth witnesses and we still affirmed, notwithstanding the conflict, that's a piece of law that we probably need to follow.
Right, and I also have cited other cases that I believe both have Commonwealth witnesses.
Because I understand that to be the distinction here. These are Commonwealth witnesses that are in, quote, complete conflict.
Let me address that next, because I would argue certainly they're not in complete conflict.
I hear you.
And it's a matter of perspective here. This was a very complicated case factually with three different offenders. We know that because there were three different types of bullets found from three different guns. And so the testimony from Sir Thomas Boyd, who saw two of the offenders, one of which was the co-defendant Roy Turner, who, by the way, had Mr. Wood's name in his cell phone, that his nickname, Ruger, in his cell phone, showing that they certainly knew one another, had been communicating that night, was coming from one place, and he did not actually see the shooting. He testified he heard shots, but that he was around the corner and could not see, or his vision was blocked from the actual shooting. So he was not in a position to see he did not see the victim, rather, being shot. And we know from Ms. Lachey's testimony that Joshua Wood was very close to the victim when he shot the victim. And she ran, and from her vantage, she saw very close Mr. Wood come up and shoot the victim in the hip. And then she ran, and then she turned around and saw him standing over the victim and shooting some more. But we know here that there were three separate guns in this case. There were three separate shooters. And none of the testimony proves that Mr. Wood was not one of those shooters. There were multiple people around outside during this time frame. And the fact that Mr. Koval looked and didn't see Joshua Wood as a person who was one of the multiple people who was around does not mean that he was not one of the shooters. So again, he had run by the time the shots started firing. He never testified. He saw who was shooting the victim, and he was running and hiding at that point. So it's not inconsistent with what Ms. Lachey testified to.
Ms. Bourne, let's talk about the text. Why is that not something that was inadmissible in terms of the text messages?
Well, first of all, I would say it was not offered for the truth of the matter asserted. We have a text going out from the defendant's phone saying, "Ride behast that scene, bro." And then there are some responses.
Well, there's no argument about the outgoing text from the appellant.
Absolutely. But
in reference to the incoming responses.
The responses add context to that original text. Much like the Lynch case, although it's not an adoptive admission here, because I would argue these texts in and of themselves are not incriminating, per se, by their language, it's light outside. It wasn't offered to prove that it's light outside. D's following me. Not offered to prove D's following me. It's offered to prove that this person, who is the recipient of the text, "Ride past that scene, bro," is actually doing what he's been directed to do. And because of that reason, it's not offered for the truth of the matter asserted. It's circumstantial evidence that explains the original text. In addition, it's admissible because it explains what the defendant's subsequent conduct, or conduct that occurred right around that period of time.
Isn't that the more traditional basis for accepting such otherwise hearsay evidence. It explains the conduct that ensued.
Exactly.
That to me is classic exception law and to hearsay evidence.
Yes, Your Honor. And here what we have is the conduct, the additional conduct that was explained was that he is then accessing news programs about the shooting right after he's receiving, or right around the same time that he's receiving these texts. He is accessing those. He's accessing a known, well, not known by anybody else at that time, but known by the person who would have been the shooter's eyewitness Facebook page right around that period of time, right after receiving those texts. So it adds context to his conduct that occurred right around the same time. Beyond that, I would argue that it's harmless error in this case, given the mountains, I would argue, of circumstantial evidence in this case, in addition to the direct testimony of Ms. Lachey. We have here such evidence as Ms. Lachey identified him at trial. She identified him in a lineup 6 days after the shooting. His phone was near the scene of the murder at the time of the murder. He contacted a co-defendant by the telephone. He accessed news stories about the murder.
Before, let me stop you about the phone. I think Mr. Broccoletti would indicate there was, in terms of the phone, that there was a north hit on the phone, not necessarily in the area.
Well,
so if you're talking about mountains of evidence, I mean, isn't that something that maybe could cut both ways?
I would argue that it was up to the fact finder to decide the relevance of that. And here, it has to be viewed in the evidence has to be viewed in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth. And here, the officer testified that it did not exclude his phone being in the area at the time of the shooting, because it was in between. It was in between towers, but that also could be in the coverage area, he testified to, as argued on brief. Again, all of this is circumstantial evidence viewed in its totality, and it has to be viewed in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth. Ms. Lachey, there were corroborating circumstances that she testified to that supported her recollection of what happened, for example, that were corroborated by other witnesses. She testified that there were two women at the scene with NW and LA on their backside. And Mr. Riggs also saw those same letters emblazoned on the backside of one of the witnesses that was near the shooting. Coville heard a commotion, which also corroborates what she said, that there was a tussle with the gun and then he ran. So her testimony was corroborated by Coville. All of the witnesses heard numerous gunshots, which corroborates what she said. So for all of these reasons, I would argue that the evidence was sufficient to convict here, and I would also argue that the texts were properly admitted because they were not hearsay, offered for the truth of the matter asserted. But if they were inadvisedly or admitted, then the evidence was overwhelming and it was harmless error. Unless the court has further questions for me, I would just ask that you respond.
Thank you, Ms. Ford. Ms. Broccoletti?
To address the court's question with respect to the conduct and the traditional hearsay, and I agree with you. Often we have an officer that receives some hearsay and the officer does X, Y, and Z as a result of that particular circumstance. And it's not offered for the truth of the matter, but to explain why the officer did what he did. That's not the question that's before the court with respect to these texts. These texts don't cause any conduct on the part of Mr. Wood with respect to anything that he does after the fact. They're offered solely for the fact, pray for some heavy rain, it's light. It's not meaning that it's light outside. It means that the rain at that moment is light. D following me. The detective testified, D means a detective. If it's offered just for context, if it's offered to show what the defendant was going to do afterwards, if it's offered to show the state of mind of the defendant, then there was no need to have a detective.
Well, irrespective of whether the statement, for example, D following me or it's light, whether that's true or not, the question is why it's, you know, what the purpose of it is for being offered. The fact that the detective testified that he was in fact following somebody you know, certainly corroborates that if it were offered for the truth, but if it was offered simply to show that it was made, or in this case, not just that it was made, but to show the linkage between the cell phones, because we're talking about text messages here, that you know, from one co-defendant to another co-defendant's cell phone at a point in time and a place in time based on cell towers that is relevant to the case, none of that constitutes hearsay, does it?
I agree. This isn't a co-defendant's cell phone. This is some unknown person. That's the issue with hearsay. So these people, whoever is writing this, pray for some heavy rain. It's light. He's following me.
Well, it's really not offering to show what the weather is it?
Sure it is, because of the...
What's the relevance of the weather?
To disturb the crime scene, to eliminate forensic evidence, to move shell casings, blood, multiple things like that. But this is not a co-defendant's text that it's going to. This is some unknown person, which is why we objected under the hearsay.
Well, that would be a relevance objection, not a hearsay objection, wouldn't it?
Well, it's hearsay because it's coming in from a third party who's not there.
But if it's not being offered for its truth, in other words, if it's not being offered to show that someone is praying for rain, which is what the statement is in that isolated instance, then it's not hearsay.
That's correct, but there's no other alternative explanation or possibility of its...
Well, then it would be irrelevant, not hearsay. I mean, so it's, you know, maybe it's apples and oranges, but, you know, if the objection is objection hearsay and it's not being offered for its truth, then the court is not wrong in overruling the objection. On the other hand, you know, if the objection is relevance and it's not relevant, the Commonwealth hasn't established relevance, then the error would be in not sustaining the objection.
Well, I'd also argue that it is not harmless error with respect to that, because when you consider the other conflicts that we went through previously in the context of the entire case, that it's additional evidence that weighs against the defendant. So thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Buckley. We will come down to Greek Council and take up the next matter.